Ken, Tony Snow, well, former NPR commentator, too.
That's true, and a former speechwriter for the first President Bush, and anybody who could write speeches for the first President Bush must be a very qualified guy. An interesting choice, and in the fact that he's basically an ideologue. He's not hesitated to criticize President Bush over the last couple of years over what he feels has been a betrayal of conservative causes. Betrayal may be too strong of a word, but you don't usually see an ideologue in that kind of a position. But he has a good reputation with the press, and he knows a lot of these reporters firsthand. And Scott McClellan was really kind of, over his head a lot of ways. He didn't lie to the press, but he didn't have much credibility because I don't think he was told much from the White House. I don't know if that'll change with Tony Snow, but it'll certainly be a more affable face.
Mm-hmm. You wonder, Tony Snow has made comments, and these are being, of course, gleefully sent around Washington, D.C. by Democratic operatives today. He's described the president as something of an embarrassment, a leader who's lost control of the federal budget, and the architect of a listless domestic policy. This is the guy who's on his side.
Right. But, he'll probably say, well, you should see what I said about the other guy. So, look, Tony Snow is, well-liked by the Bush supporters. And again, I have a feeling the final 2 years of the Bush administration will be much of an us versus them mentality. And who better to do us than Tony Snow?
Email question. Now, Mike in Iowa City wants to know, the White House press secretary often must refuse to answer questions even after being asked the same question time after time. Will it be difficult for a columnist who's used to speaking his mind to say, I can't comment on an ongoing investigation?
Well, that's a good question. But, Mike McCurry did it very, very well. Mike McCurry, when he was brought in as the Clinton press secretary in the middle of Watergate, he just said, look, Watergate, instead of Monica, Monica Gate.
Oh, yeah.
Some other gate.
Keep those straight, will you, Ken?
Some other gate, I'm sorry. In 1988, said, look, I'm not asking about information for this because I don't want to know about it, so I won't lie to you. But Tony Snow has never hesitated about talking about what he has to say. And could his mouth get him in trouble? Possibly, but it wouldn't be the first time a White House press secretary got himself in trouble.
And let's turn to some local politics around the country. An important mayoral primary in the city of New Orleans over the weekend. This was to pick, as it turned out, two people who then have to run off against each other. One of the victors, the current mayor, Ray Nagin.
It's fascinating. I mean, there's so many fascinating and tragic things about New Orleans. But 4 years ago, Ray Nagin was the choice of the white conservative business establishment in New Orleans. He ran against a fellow African-American candidate, and he won, again, with white support. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, the white support just left him completely. There were three main candidates in the primary on Saturday. Ron Foreman was a white businessman. He headed the zoo, the Audubon Society, and it got a lot of white conservative support. His wife used to be Ray Nagin's press secretary. Ray Nagin was left with African-American voter support, which was a complete opposite of 4 years ago. And the person who's going into the runoff with Nagin is Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu, the brother of Senator Mary Landrieu, the son of the last white mayor, Moon Landrieu, left office in 1978. Mitch Landrieu has put together a coalition of white and blacks, and the whole Landrieu family has a history of assembling coalitions of whites and blacks. Given the fact that Ron Foreman endorsed Mitch Landrieu yesterday or 2 days ago, it's going to be really tough, probably nearly impossible for Ray Nagin to win a second term.
And after the first vote in the primary, both successors came out and said, well, we hope this doesn't become divisive racially. Is that a realistic hope?
Well, the candidates the candidates are not demagogues, and they certainly will not demagogue race, but that's not to say that their supporters won't. We saw some candidates on both white and black candidates in the initial primary talk about race in stark terms. Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton have clearly talked about how important having an African American mayor in a once majority black city is important to them. But you can't help but face the fact that after 30 years of black mayors, that time may be coming to an end.
Next week, there will be primaries in three states, Ohio, Indiana, and North Carolina. In Ohio, televisions have been airing the usual run of political advertisements for and against various candidates. But one in Ohio's 6th congressional district is a little different.
Sewage dumps, cover-ups, and dirty secrets. We know we can't trust Charlie Wilson to do what's right. And Bob Carr, a liberal Democrat, Bob Carr is too far to the left to work with Republicans in Washington. Carr hasn't even ruled out trying to eliminate President Bush's tax cuts and could fight for environmental regulations that would hurt businesses. Bob Carr, too liberal for Congress.
Now, you might think that was put out by somebody on in their own party. Turns out that's not true.
This is a wonderful political story. As you say earlier, a Machiavellian story. The fact is, nobody in the world has ever heard of Bob Carr. The reason the Republican Party is going after Bob Carr in this district, this is a district that Ted Strickland is giving up to when he's running for governor, is because the Democratic frontrunner in the seat is a guy named, a state senator named Charlie Wilson. Charlie Wilson had all the endorsements, all the money. He was clearly the favorite for win the seat, but he could not come up with 50 valid signatures to file for the primary. His son, he put his son in charge of it. Mm-hmm. That's his first mistake. And he wound up getting 98 signatures. Most of them were from a different congressional district. So Charlie Wilson now has to run as a write-in candidate. And a Democrat who's also already on the ballot is a guy named Bob Carr. The Republican Party is obviously afraid of Charlie Wilson. He's a good candidate. He'll be a strong candidate.
As long as he keeps his son out of the campaign.
Exactly right. And so they're running these ads against this guy named Bob Carr. So if I'm a liberal Democrat back home and I say, wait, the Republican Party is running against this Bob Carr, he must be a neat guy. So maybe he's the guy I'm going to vote for. Otherwise, nobody would have heard of his name.
Well, joining us now is Bill Binning. He's chair of the Political Science Department at Youngstown State University in Youngstown, Ohio. He's with us by phone from his office there. Very nice of you to join us today.
Glad to be here.
Now, this ad, is it working? Is Bob Carr is the candidate to beat in the 6th District?
Well, I don't know how effective the ad is, but yes, for Charlie Wilson, Bob Carr is on the ballot.
Uh-huh.
And many Democrats, we assume, are going to go in, not see Charlie Wilson's name, and they'll be voting for Bob Carr. So Charlie Wilson's challenge, who is, as was pointed out, the favorite of the party and the person who is seen as the one who can win, he needs to get more write-in votes than Bob Carr gets as a ballot candidate. So what's going on here is that the Republicans are trying to dampen Charlie Wilson's vote by running a negative ad and building up, sort of a backhanded way of building up Carr's vote by saying he's too liberal.
So, now, we here in...
Many of my colleagues at the university would be looking to vote for the most liberal candidate, so maybe they'll be taken on by that.
Well, we here in distant Washington can't be the only people who have figured this out. Surely people in Ohio are talking about this.
I'm not sure that there's a lot of talk about it. Actually, this race seems to be a more interest at the national level than locally. The local news doesn't seem to give a great deal of attention to what is a very significant race, because if next Tuesday we find out that Charlie Wilson is not the candidate, then it may very well be the Republicans are going to pick up a seat and make it even more difficult for the Democrats to get their 15 or 16 seats they need to get the majority, because currently the seat is being held by a Democrat who's vacating and
to run for governor. Yeah.
Right. Bush only won the district by 1%. So it's one of the few very competitive seats in the country. And so it's a big national story, but locally it doesn't seem to be a lot of interest. In fact, a local radio station called me today, talked about the low absentee voter turnout, that the request for absentee ballots pretty low in Mahoney County, which we're a pretty Democratic county, so it doesn't seem to be a lot of interest here in this.
Professor, it's Ken Rudin here. You know, what's fascinating to me about this is if you listen to all the headlines about Ohio in the past couple of months, it's just woes for the Republican Party. That is a financial scandal, that Governor Taft is in big trouble. I mean, he can't run again, but he's very unpopular. That Senator Mike DeWine is in trouble, that Bob Ney could be indicted. And so, you know, you think this is a great opportunity, a great state for pickups for the Democrats, and here they have somebody who can't file 50 valid signatures.
Yeah, that was a huge mistake, but it's made for a wonderful story. We're writing a paper on it that apparently what they did in the collecting of the signatures is they collected them in parts of the counties of particular counties that are in the district, but they didn't get the signatures from the part of the county that's actually in the district. So he only had 47 valid signatures and couldn't make the ballot. So
mm-hmm.
That was the beginning of what has been really a great story. His choice was to file as an independent or try to make it as a write-in. It's estimated I don't think anybody knows, but it's estimated in the paper he needs 20,000 write-in signatures to win. I don't know if that's a valid number, but that is a great task.
Could he lose the primary and still run as an independent in November?
No, we have a sore loser's law. He has to file as an independent the day before the primary in Ohio.
Mm-hmm. And I guess if he does win, Ohio voters in the 6th District don't have to worry about a family dynasty there.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know how big that is. You mean in terms of his son?
His son, the guy who didn't get the votes.
That really didn't get the big play here. I think, of course, realistically, what Ohio is facing is that if we are going to lose two seats, which is what is predicted after the next census, this could be a pretty short career for Charlie Wilson or whomever wins that seat. If Ohio's going to go down two more congressional seats, then it may very well be that person will be drawn out of his career.
And that's why the battle for the legislature matters a lot, because they get to redraw those district lines as well. Professor, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Glad to talk to you. Thank you.
Bill Binning is chair of the Political Science Department at Youngstown State University in Youngstown, Ohio, and he joined us from his office there in Youngstown, Ohio, here on the Political Junkie segment on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ken Rudin, let me ask you another big political question this week. In part, the president's polls are suffering as a result of high gas prices. He announced a four-point plan earlier this week to try to drive prices down amidst a sort of consensus among most observers that anything the president does at this point is not going to have much effect on these prices.
Not only will they probably not have an effect on the prices, but they probably won't have much effect on his 32% approval rating. And I think that could be part of it, too. The fact is that the Republicans are very, very nervous about November. And given the fact that Iraq is not going well, given the fact that spending, according to conservatives, is out of control, mm-hmm. the last thing they need now is another, you know, problem to inspire their voters to go to the polls. And $3 and up gas prices is certainly going to be one of those problems.
And spending, the president has now vowed to veto another bill. This one in the Senate. It's a must-pass measure, a lot of money for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yet, at this point, do his promises of veto carry much of a threat?
It's the child sitting in the corner of the room, you know, throwing a tantrum, saying that, you know, I'm not going to eat. You know, I'm not going to eat. I'm going to starve myself unless I get my way. President Bush has promised a veto so many times already that I would imagine it would ring hollow.
800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Clark is on the line with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just had a comment. I wanted to know, I'm still hearing a lot of politics and a lot of politicians and conservative pundits referring to any kind of parsing his words as Clintonian. I'm sure you've heard that before.
I think it has to do with the meaning of is, yeah.
The meaning of is, right. I was wondering when we're going to be able to all agree that we can start referring to that kind of double-speak from politicians as Bushonian.
I don't know. Have you decided you're the decider, Ken?
Well, you know something? There was a Bushism this week when basically he talked about the benefits, tax benefits to the oil companies. Now, in the past, when any Republican would say that I'm not going to vote to take away tax benefits because, in effect, that's a tax increase. So, in effect, what George Bush has done, what President Bush has done regarding the oil companies is that if you're taking back a tax benefit, in a sense, are you raising taxes? And is that violating one of the tenets of the Bush presidency? So that in itself certainly could be a Bushism.
I think we could have to come up with a better term than Bushonian, though.
Yeah, I just thought it was funny when you contrast the two. And obviously these things that these people in this administration are so much more severe than the kind of things we're talking about with the infraction that where Clinton was saddled with that Clintonian thing. Mm-hmm. They would like for us to say that forever, I think.
Well, some people say lying to a grand jury, if that's what he did, that's pretty serious. But anyway, we'll let that go. Clark, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Speaking of the president's shakeup at the White House, Karl Rove's duties were somewhat restricted earlier this week. He's doing less on policy, more on politics. But in fact, what he's actually preparing for this week is more testimony.
Well, actually, today he apparently went to the grand jury in the Valerie Plame affair, the Fitzgerald investigation in Washington. It's my understanding that, yes, he did testify before the grand jury today, but there's some question of whether there was just some questions that needed to be answered or there's an impending indictment. You know, of course, Louis Libby, the vice president, The Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff is under indictment in this case. But the Rove people are insisting that, no, there's just some misunderstandings. There's some things that need to be cleared up. But the fun thing about Karl Rove is that the headlines everywhere around the country even say major White House shakeup. I mean, it's you know, Karl Rove is still Karl Rove. He'll still be in charge of trying to implement some kind of a plan to salvage the Republican gains or salvage Republican control of Congress for November. And the thought of him, look, if he disappeared or if Donald Rumsfeld, you know, was no longer the defense secretary, that would be a shakeup. But, you know, replacing Andy Card with Josh Bolton and, you know, things like that is hardly a major shakeup.
Mm-hmm. As Steve Colbert, I think, said this week, it's just rearranging deck chairs on the Hindenburg. So he's speaking this weekend at the White House Correspondent Association's dinner. Should be pretty interesting. Ken Rudin, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Ken Rudin writes the Political Junkie column. You can read that at npr.org. He joins us here every Wednesday. I'm Neil Cownan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.